And in the book of Ecclesiastes, we will see on a number of occasions that Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, will give the advice to rejoice in the wife of your youth, as you saw in chapter 9, verses 7 through 10 this evening. Now, several times he will point out that a happily married couple have the greatest treasure under the sun that you can know, and that there is enormous satisfaction, great joy that is attached to that. Make sure you protect that and that you relish and appreciate that. It's my conviction, if you were here last week and the week before, as we were talking about the Song of Solomon, that it is this love, a pure and true and long-lasting married love, that is being described in the Song of Solomon. And I pointed out in those preceding lessons that there have been a couple of interpretive schemes for the Song of Solomon that have been popular among us through the years in churches of Christ that really think just can't be so. The first of these is the idea that this is some sort of a figurative or symbolic representation of the relationship between Christ and His church. Well, maybe it is, but it eludes me. The nature of what is said here in this song suggests to me that it would be odd, to say the least, that we should try to reinterpret this or try to understand it as dealing with Jesus and His relationship to the church. There'll be more on that in just a little bit. Now, another very popular approach has been that this is a sort of a play, with which I also agree, but that there are four main characters, and that the plot of this particular presentation is that Solomon is a very nasty, conniving, and evil man who is seeking to defeat, in the ways of love, a young and innocent and pure shepherd boy who has fallen in love with this young woman. And so Solomon is seeking to subvert that love and to win this woman into his harem for himself for purely prurient, say that five times fast, reasons. That what he's trying to do here is to seduce her away, and then effectively, since he's got 1,000 women in the harem anyway, you know, just kind of abandon and neglect her. And wouldn't it just be horrifying if Solomon were then to win out in this effort? And so we all should rejoice that by the end of the book, Solomon has been defeated, the shepherd boy wins, the young bride and he, you know, are married and will live happily ever after. And again, I just find this utterly unbelievable in the truest sense of those words. I cannot believe that. From the very first verse in the Song of Solomon, where you have a title, it says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Unless that is entirely incorrect, and Solomon did not write this song, then it's pretty weird that he would write a song, chief among them, he'll identify it, in which he is the cad who needs to be defeated. He's just a bad guy. Now, brethren, I haven't written very many songs. Matter of fact, only one. So one of these days, if I get courage enough, I'll share it with you. But I have written one. I guarantee you that in that song, that particular hymn that I, you know, have toyed with, I am not the bad guy. Okay? Why would I ever do that? What I think we have here is only three characters in a magnificent song that is the magnum opus of Solomon's 1,005, as we were told in 1 Kings, and that it is lengthy enough to be presented as a play in which there are three parts. One of those is a chorus. We don't know how many voices, you know, would be in that group. And the other is the young woman and the young man, and Solomon is that man, and he's a good guy. And he is singing about the beauty and joys of a lifelong relationship with a wife that he dearly loves above all others. There is no fourth guy, okay? Just the three. Now, hopefully everybody will have received one of these papers, which is really kind of a rough-looking thing, I know. But I wrapped this together with a bunch of just facts, and hopefully it will be helpful for you in identifying the way that this play was presented to the Israeli people 3,000 years ago, when first it was written and then began to be presented throughout the various cities in Israel. Now, all I've done here, and we mentioned this last week, I promised you I'd give you this, but in the upper block with the larger print there, this is how I would divide this song so that we can see the scenes that take place in the play itself. So, verse 1, as you see there, is just the title, and there's that's an incorrect, obviously. I had a problem with some work I was doing in the editing there, and obviously you should say one verse and not eight verse. No, it's one verse. But then, chapter 1, verses 2 through 11 is the harem scene, which we saw last week, in which this young woman has been brought into the palace of the king and is being prepared for her courtship with him. Then in chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 17, you have the actual courtship itself taking place. You see there, there's 23 verses there, which makes it the third longest section in the play. It is developed at some length as they are enjoying their first days and weeks and months together and are engaging in a courtship. Hopefully much like any one of us may have already experienced or would hope to. Then in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, there's a dream sequence. Rather short, it's only five verses, but the young bride falls asleep. She has this dream. Then in chapter 3, verse 6 through chapter 5, verse 1, there is a wedding scene, and it is grand. It's tied to the longest section in the book, 27 verses that are devoted to the opulent splendor of King Solomon on his wedding day to his young bride. And then in chapter 5, verse 2 through chapter 6, verse 3, you have a nightmare. This young woman now is dreaming again about a terrible circumstance in which now she is torn apart from her lover and she can't find her beloved. And it's just a terrible thing that goes on, you know, for quite a long time, 18 verses. And then, of course, that is resolved with her coming together with him again, the nightmare ending. Then in chapter 6, verse 4 through chapter 8, verse 4, you have those years in which the courtship is over, the wedding is over, the honeymoon is over, and the honeymoon is not over. They are loving this. It is great. It's the way it always ought to be. No 7-year itch. Okay? This is a wonderful thing. It's the way it ought to be. And so they are going through then those middle to later years in which they have known and loved each other now year after year after year. And then finally, the last 10 verses, chapter 8, verse 5 through 14 there, is their final years. They have had a very long marriage, hopefully 50 years. Anyway, Harrison's about to celebrate their anniversary, 50 years. You know, and they are still as happily married and as much in love as ever they were. It is the song of songs, brethren. It is a song about love. Now, the next part of this, and very technical and very boring and all, but you know, there are these three, in my understanding of the book, cast members. So what I've tried to do, to get it on a single page, you know, is to draw all these squares and all that. But you'll notice in that first column in the upper part, I've taken chapter 1 and identified each of the parts by the verse numbers. The bride begins the song, the chorus joins her, the bride sings another solo again, the chorus is back again, Solomon appears on the scene now for three verses, the bride sings again for three verses, Solomon is back again, and there's the bride again, and you have what is known as antiphonal singing. Back and forth in the presentation upon a stage, most likely the best singers and musicians in Israel have assembled together to present this back and forth presentation. Then in the second column, the one to the right there, you have chapter 2, the bride, Solomon, the bride, Solomon, the bride, Solomon, and the bride. Chapter 3, the bride, Solomon, and the chorus. Chapter 4, only two parts, Solomon and the bride. Then you go to the lower part of the charts there. You have chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8. And please note that as you're identifying all of these, if you're wanting to make marks in your Bible, as I did by employing three different colors and just highlighting the verse number itself, it has served to make a great deal more sense to me then. Each time I go back to the Song of Solomon, take the time when you get home tonight, go painstakingly and painfully through this chart. I did it. You can. okay, put this thing together, and then if you'll somehow use a triangle, a square, and a circle around the verse, or use colors like I did, but break it up, you know, as I've suggested, then the book will make a lot more sense as you read through it time and time again throughout your life. So, if you didn't get one of these, make sure you do. Before I leave, Gene, did you just leave them on the table back there? Where'd you go? I guess he's probably out in the foyer there. And so, make sure you pick one of those up before you leave. Okay, now, to come to the slides for just a second, this particular scene that you see before you is an olive grove. Coincidentally, this morning we were talking about the betrayal, how Judas came and betrayed the Lord. It would have been in a setting somewhat like this. Most of you are probably familiar. Olive trees are, you know, very unusual kind of a tree. But an old growth like you see in this particular orchard is also, particularly in the summertime, you know, just a wonderfully cool and shady bower that you might enter into. We will see scenes kind of like this in the course of the Song of Solomon. And for instance, he's going to talk about goats more than once. He's going to compare his beloved to goats, if you can believe that. But it's going to be a picture of loveliness and beauty, as we'll discuss at a later date there. But this is also the Mount of Olives, known, of course, because all of these are olive trees, though a younger growth than you saw in the picture earlier. These are all olive trees through here, working up the hillside here. All these are olive trees. This is the Mount of Olives. To this day, for now 2,000 years plus, it's a perfect environment and location, you know, for the use of those olives. I might point out here that in this photograph here in 2011 it was, that I told you I'd hiked around the city walls. It takes 3.5 hours to walk around the city of Jerusalem. There's a little roadway right here, and I had come down the Kidron Valley from this side and up this hill right here, hopped over a stone fence. I was in some kind of private property, I'm a little bit nervous about it, but I jumped over that fence right there. Came down this fence and then walked through here, and they have this wonderful staircase and pathway. It takes you down to the bottom of the Kidron Valley, and then a very similar structure that goes up the other side to the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. This, as you know, is my habit for those of you that are normally here, to have some sort of a title slide that references material we've been studying. These two pictures have nothing to do with the Song of Solomon whatsoever. Should have used them this morning. But it was on my mind. Remember when we were talking about Judas betraying the Lord, that if Jesus was on this very hillside, in and among these groves of olives somehow, that he would have been able to see very clearly in the night the torches, hear the sound across this very narrow and small valley as they were coming to arrest him. They would have been coming up the pathway, you know, something like this. You'd be looking down and watching them come. Now, one last time, just to review, what you have on the page to take home is this outline, as I understand the Song of Solomon, and then each of the cast's references, verse references, for when they sing. So I realize you can't read this now, I don't intend for you to, but this is just the way that it is separated out to the end of the book, which I'm now going to leave as we take up the second part of the book, which is that second scene beginning at chapter 1 and verse 12. We ended last week with verse 11, and that will be taking us then through chapter 2, verse 17, which is the courtship scene. So now, Solomon and or some sort of scouts that he would send out into his kingdom for his various wives and concubines has identified this young woman as a candidate for marriage. She then has been called in, much like Esther was, to be prepared for the presence of the king. She is bedecked with all the finery that the kingdom can afford. She is given all of the emoluments, you know, to make a woman attractive and beautiful, you know, so all the cosmetics and the perfumes and all that. And now she is going to be spending some time with the king himself. So in chapter 1 and verse 12, she speaks. It is the bride. You've got my notes there that I've handed out to identify each of these various speakers. So singing, the lead part in the song, someone singer, I presume, like Jeannie Crabtree, who we've just lost, as you know, but it was singing professionally and had toured Europe and been, you know, with groups very famous here in Eugene, would then a single voice be heard, "While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, a perfume, which lies all night between my breasts." She has, is a crude way to put it, and steeping in this perfume throughout the night. "My beloved," part of the preparations for the king that they do in the harem, "my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." I fouled up because just this week I received from the man who will be leading the tour in September, October to Israel that I'm planning to attend for my third trip. Now, he had taken a wonderful photograph of the oasis at En-Gedi. En-Gedi is a seaside resort. That is to say, it is a beautiful location. Not that it has a hotel or anything, but, you know, beautiful location. That is right on the Dead Sea, which was a vacation, you know, highly desired location throughout all of Israel's history in the colder months. Summertime, of course, is most oppressive, lowest place on earth, gets up 120, 130 degrees, very difficult, but through many months, extremely pleasant, while the rest of Israel may have snow on the mountains. King Herod had a very tremendous palace down there, much of which still remains, some ruins remain. And so at En-Gedi, you also have a year-round river and a series of just beautiful waterfalls. They come cascading down through a series of pools, very dramatic, very beautiful, and of course the canyon filled with the lush vegetation that all of this moisture splashing, you know, and the humidity of it, you know, allowing the canyon sides to grow. Wish I'd have brought that picture here, but I didn't think about it tonight. And they are just saying, "I find you attractive. You are beautiful to me. I love the way you look. And this is just fine. There's nothing untoward about it. People enjoy each other's physical beauty and ought to. They're enamored with each other." He responds to her song in verse 15, "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves." As I've mentioned, I'm going to have a number of references here that would sound, you know, kind of weird to us maybe, but it is the poetry of their day. She responds in verse 16, "How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our houses, plural, are cedars. Our rafters, cypresses. I am the rose of Sharon, the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys." What are we reading? Poetry, songs of love, which are being written to this day as they speak of the joy that they take in each other's presence. And again, no matter though some have tried to sully this courtship, you know, the fact that she says that their couch, you know, is luxuriant and the beams of our houses are cedars and rafters, they're not misbehaving in any way. People in those days lay down at a table to eat, remember? They would recline to eat. These couches are the standard fare. They're not misbehaving in any way. It is a courtship where they're spending time together. And as is the case today. You can remember, those of you that have been married for 50 years, what it was like. Okay? In those days of courtship, how do you prepare yourself for a date? You think about it. You try to look the best you can. You want to smell the best you can. You've got to have your teeth brushed. You know? And then, you, when you go out, you want to have settings that will lend themselves to courtship. So you think about where you want to go and what you want to do. How many places would Solomon have to take a woman on a date? He's the richest guy in the whole of the Middle East, you know, at that time. And so they have houses, they have all these
think, you know, she's just marveling.
And this afternoon, this is a very poor, you know, example, but this afternoon, Donna and I were invited by two different groups of people to go out for lunch. So I said, Jerry, sure, we'll go and we'll have lunch with your group. Meanwhile, Donna was committing and we have lunch with somebody else. So now we were committed to two different places, called frantically, couldn't get a hold of, you know, let Jerry and his group know. But we wound up at the Wings restaurant at the Eugene Airport. You ever been there? Okay, so there we were. We're sitting in the Wings restaurant at the airport. And I counted a glue lamb. Dean and the rest of you guys in construction will appreciate this. A glue lamb. My wife was, you know, laughing at me here. Donna thinks, you know, that's the things I would do. And I counted each of the 2x4 layers in the glue lamb. Wow. There were 36 of them. That's the biggest beam I think I've ever seen. And it is an ambiance that you have there. That's kind of impressive. And sitting crossways on top of that beam was, guess what? Another one. And so, like in this room, when you have big, huge beams like that, what are they supporting? Great loads. And usually also long spans. So that when she's saying, whoa, look at the beams in this place, what is she describing? Cavernous, glorious, very expensive, marvelous thing. You know, that makes an old contractor like me want to go ahead and count to see what all went into it. So, we're enjoying our time together. It's a marvelous location. And then, in verse 1, I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. Open your songbooks, everybody. Grab your songbook and look at number 445. 445 is called Jesus, Rose of Sharon. Guess what it's coming from, what the idea is from? This verse. And what sort of interpretation of the Song of Solomon was then being employed as the foundation for this song? Thinking that Jesus is the Rose of Sharon. Now, you've read with me last week the first scene. You've read with me so far about half of the second scene, maybe a third of it. Does it sound to you like this is a discussion of Jesus and the church? Really doesn't to me. That would be so highly figurative as to escape my, you know, capabilities in trying to see comparisons there. Look now at song number 594. Which is entitled, guess what? Yeah, that's it. Where did they get the idea here? Same thing. Finding an expression, a poetic expression, back here in the Song of Solomon, and then applying it to Jesus. Now, I hope I'm not ruining these songs for you. I really don't intend to. I think you still sing them. The idea is still about love and beauty and being enthralled with someone that you are deeply indebted to and appreciate and want to spend time with. So that's fine, you know, to take that sort of, quote, poetic license. But I just want to point out, I really don't think that's what the author Solomon was trying to do in the Song of Solomon. Now, please turn to number 576. 576 is Faith is the Victory, in Camp Along the Hills of Light, Christian Soldiers Rise. When you get over there, look at the start of the second verse. His banner over us is what? Love. His banner over us is love. What a great idea. What a beautiful, you know, symbolic representation of our going out to fight a war for Jesus who loves us so much. You know, and so you've got all these kind of juxtaposed images and ideas there. Come back to the Song of Solomon, and let's continue the reading. In chapter 2, we have verse 1, I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley, sings this young woman. In verse 2, Solomon responds, like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. She responds, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, soul is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down. And his fruit was sweet to my taste. He's brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Okay? There's where that idea came from. Should it surprise us that the Song of Songs would find its way into our hymns, into our songbook? Well, this is far from the only place where this happens. And again, sing those songs, enjoy those songs, you know, be built up and edified by those songs. Just be aware that we are taking this these symbolic figurative expressions now and kind of reworking them from the setting that was taking place here in the Song of Solomon. So in verse 5, and again, if you have my little chart there, verses 3 through 6 is the bride to be. Verse 5, she sings, sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. At which point, apparently, in the song, they have been spending a lot of time together. Again, it is perfectly pure and upright. But if they have been now lying on this couch and talking and looking at the beauty, you know, some giant room, you know, of Solomon's there, she appears to have fallen asleep. And so now Solomon, which is, by the way, one of the most beautiful images that anybody knows, is to see someone that you truly love in that peaceful repose. There's, you know, in a sleeping face, a vision of loveliness that you cannot see when they're awake. It's different when someone is slumbering. And so he now apparently addresses the chorus in verse 7, and he says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, which suggests that the chorus was made up entirely out of women, perhaps. They are the daughters of Jerusalem in the chorus. He says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, the deer, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. So what is he doing? He sees that she falls asleep. It is a vision of loveliness. And you can imagine a song coming down from some, you know, larger crescendo, and now he quiets down, and you have the most skillful singer and composer ever producing all the full range of emotions that song can draw out from you, and now we have, you know, the softer tones as this scene, you know, shows her sleeping, and he apparently leaves her there. Now, by the way, while all this courtship is going on, what does verse 7 tell us? He's got maybe 50 or 100 witnesses. There's not anything wrong about what they're doing, us sneaking around and hiding, you know, and all the thoughts that a lot of people, you know, might think to sully the reputation of these two. It's nothing like that. You know, all the play, what they're doing is very above board, is very, very public. You know, Solomon has, you know, the presence of these people in the song itself. Now then, she apparently wakes, and in verse 8, listen, my beloved, behold, he's coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He's looking through the windows. He's peering through the lattice. My beloved responded and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along, for behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened the figs. The vines and blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. So their courtship, apparently, and imagine the stage being set, and they've got all kinds of scenery, you know, that's been built like we would do today in a play, has all been taking so far, remember the cedars and the beams, you know, and all of that, so far the courtship's been taking place where? Indoors. When? Winter time. And now, Jesus,
sleeping, you know, as the voices come to softness, and he slips away as she wakes up, and now, here he comes, and he is announcing what? Springtime, the season of love. And so now what are we going to do? Let's just run and dance and prance about, you know, all of Israel. Let's go see, you know, how beautiful it is. And we're now going to share this love, you know, in the out-of-doors. And you can imagine a scenery change, you know, and the play continues to unfold. And so Solomon appears, or whoever's representing him in the play, you know, and he's looking for his beloved, and he's calling for her. And then, are we still in hushed and whispered tones as this song is being sung? No. Behold! See, and so what happens? Immediately, you know, you go to a probably faster beat, you have more voices involved, everything gets louder, everything gets more energetic, you're doing the whole range. It is the song of what? The song of songs. It is the best of them all. And so it is taking them through the full range of human emotion and the full range of human voices and the full range of the various types and kinds of music. And so then in verse 14, after she's singing her joy of seeing him coming and comparing him, you know, to being athletic and strong, you know, he's a captain of the football team and leaping about on the mountains and all that. Then in verse 14, he sings, oh my God. In the cleft of the rock, in the secret place of the steep pathway. Let me see your form. Let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet and your form is lovely. She's a beautiful girl. And he tells her so. Very few guys in courtship are going to say, you know, you're as ugly as the old gray bear who ate what she used to be. No, it's just, you praise the physical beauty and that's just the way it ought to be. You guys are learning how to be romancers. You women as well in the song. Then the chorus, 15. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom. Well, it's a common thing that they had to do. This young woman has explained that she's been involved in those kinds of activities, and that accounts for the fact that she was not as physically attractive and her skin not so beautiful as these other ladies, you know, here in the harem. And so you have then an allusion to that, a reference to that. But also, when you're doing that, if you're chasing those foxes around, what kind of activity is that? So once again, it's very fast, it's very frenetic, and it's kind of fun, really. I want you guys to understand, not only can I summon visitors on command, I am so athletic that in my much younger days, I actually ran a rabbit down. I did. Now, he was in a box canyon and he couldn't get out. Thereby they have it. And all I had to do was run back and forth while he ran around all the bushes until the fourth day finally was exhausted and flopped over, and I brought him triumphantly back to camp about 11 years old. I ran a rabbit down! Okay? It was kind of fun. And this is the scene. Let's just take foxes out, you know, through the vineyards. Then, the courtship scene closes with the last two verses of chapter 2 as the bride-to-be sings, my beloved is mine, and I am his. He pastures his flocks among the lilies. How beautiful would that scene be? Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the mountains of Bether. Okay? They each, in poetic language, praising the beauty, the prowess, you know, of their physicality and of their love. And that scene closes. Apparently the day closes. We change the scenery on the set, and the dream scene will begin for only 5 verses next week. Now, was that the weirdest lesson you ever heard on a Sunday night? I mean, bar none, right? So either that's my power or their fault. Okay, one of the two. But there you are. The Song of Solomon, Act 2, here this evening. As always, though, we do, in all seriousness, want to say that
that the Church of Jesus Christ is His beloved. He takes as much pleasure in it, certainly, as these two did in each other. We have in the church, you know, great power and great help in each the other's support in prayer. And we have, of course, the love of our God and of Jesus, you know, upon us. And if we can be of help to you in some struggle that you have going on, or if perhaps you've been studying and are ready now to commit yourself to Him, to become a Christian this night, then let it be so. Please come speak with me now as we sing our final song.